Even as a young girl, I was told two things. First, never go into the forest. No matter how much it called, no matter what delight stands just out of sight, and no matter whom you saw beckoning you forward, never go into the forest. The second rule, even simpler. If you go to the forest, leave before the sun sets. This rule I kept religiously. I would not be caught in the wood after dark, never. Still, they called me witch, sorceress, demon spawn. I didn't care because it meant they feared my magic, of which I had none. Only herbs, leaves, dirt. Of course, to my face, they named me Sister. Sister, come quick. The baby has a chill. Sister, the pox has taken father. Sister, the burn will not heal. Sister. I did what I could. Small things. They paid me in berries, in rabbit, in apples, things snatched from the edge of the forest. They all paid, but not the twins. They lived in the woodcutter's house, and they neither asked nor did they give. They watched. They watched as I left for the forest. They watched at twilight as I emerged again. You see, our forest was a liar. A moving trickster jigsaw puzzle. That's why I threw the waystones, so I could find my way back. Full pockets of white stones dropped one at a time in the forest. A trail back home to save me from facing the night when the forest did more than move. Like every other creature, this forest had a heart. Twice I had glimpsed it. Once it appeared as a magic castle off in the distance. The other, it was a glowing cave. Each time, I saw it only as the sun raced towards the horizon, leaving no time for exploration. Instead, I ran back, following my stone trail before the forest turned black. I needed more time, so one day, I set off at first light. This morning, the twins flashed their shared grin at me as I raced into the forest. It occurred to me then that they knew. They'd seen the heart. No matter. I felt drawn, led, but still, I was careful to place the stones. This forest was not my friend. I ignored the shrieks, the whispers, the promises calling from either side, moving only toward the center. A few steps at a time, orienting, a few more steps, orienting again. Then, with the sun still high in the sky, I saw it. A cottage made of story. Shimmering wisp of fairy dance around her eaves, her frame, her chimney. A cobblestone path led to her door. The grasses, the birds, the wind, the sky sang one song together here. Beauty distilled. I walked down the path, knocked on the glowing door. No answer. But when I pushed, it opened without resistance. The smell of fresh bread and sequins lured me inside. A fire roared in the hearth. A tea kettle bubbled beside it. And there in the center of the room, on a table, lay a single enormous book. I opened it. On the first page, there was written a single word in a dark, angry script. It said simply, "Tricked." I turned the page. Tricked. Tricked. Every page of the book, the same word in the same scrawl. I dropped the tome, looked to the storybook window, and see the sun plummeting from the sky, the hearth burst, fire knocking the kettle over in a rage. I seize open the door, setting sun glowing in the distance. I run, searching for my waystones. Instead, I see nothing. I redouble my search, nothing. None of my stones lay where I had dropped them, so I run blind into the dark forest. I run, death chasing, I run. The forest, grabbing at every turn, leaves like fingers, grasping, holding, leathery wings flapping in the above. I run, crashing, bloody gashes slash into my arms, my legs, my face. I run toward light. What light? I know not, but I run toward it. Even as the monster chases, hot breath hissing behind me, I run. And when I crash through the clearing, only then do I understand what I'm running toward. Torches. They wait with torches, vowing to kill any that come from the dark forest. My neighbors, thick farmer hands, yank me from the ground, ready to carry out the sentence. I see the twins, tittering, one to the other, each holding a fistful of stones. My waystones. My path. Hansel! I scream, Gretel, tell them! Tell them what you did! They laugh. And as a crowd of neighbors draws closer, I know that if they want a witch, I must give them one. Touch me, I hiss. Touch me, and I will rain curses upon your children. Know that the dark night will never leave your nursery. It hurts me to tell this lie. I had pulled most of their children from the womb, heard their first cries. I could never hurt them. Still, my words sting like a lash. They pull back, glancing one to the other, before returning to their own homes. I look toward the twins, and with absolute cold certainty, I know that it is either them or me. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, The Path. Amazing stories from real people finding a way out of no way. My name is not Glenn Washington. Lock yourself away from everybody and everything, because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Now, we're going to start off today's episode with a piece from a woman who can find paths that no one else can see. Snap Judgment's Anna Sussman has a story.
In the still early hours of the morning, in the Cottonwood campground deep in the Colorado desert, a tiny 9-year-old girl named Mandy quietly pulled on her sandals, opened the door to her family's camper, and tiptoed out into the vast desert. When the family woke up, they had no idea where Mandy was. All they saw was sand.
Everything in me stopped. Everything goes empty. I felt a deep, empty dread, and especially for a child.
Hannah Nyala was the first person to respond from the Joshua Tree search and rescue team.
We got the knock on our door. I got sent immediately to the campground to try to secure the scene, to try to figure out if we could get a footprint, to do all the basic things that you have to do to try to lock it down.
The first thing Hannah did was talk to Mandy's mom and sister about Mandy's shoes. What size were they? What did they look like? Hannah was able to find an imprint of Mandy's shoe pretty easily near their camper. She drew a picture of it, measured it, and then went searching for a trail of these tiny footprints to lead her out of the campground.
I went alongside the main road of the campground, about 30 feet out. Time felt split. It was absolutely racing like a freight train, on the one hand, with me being behind Mandy and not having a good track yet. And then the other piece of it Time was passing excruciatingly slowly while I was looking for that first footprint.
It took less than an hour for Hannah and the tracking team to find Mandy's trail outside the campground. Hannah circled the first footprint with her tracking stick, a sawed-off golf club, and then she followed little Mandy into the desert, step by step.
As the hours passed, we were aware of the time. What I think about in the desert is temperature first. It's going to start dropping quickly. That's foremost on my mind more than anything else, is we've got to get to this child before she's facing hypothermia. After more than an hour of working the track itself and on her trail, we then had one helicopter in the air, and there was a fixed wing as well, which also was crisscrossing the area. They built a search base, emergency operations vehicles, a fuel truck. People were bringing meals in. It was a big effort. There were a lot of people. There were well over 100.
Are you building a relationship with her in your head?
You do. I build a relationship from the beginning. By the time I found the first footprint, I was as connected to Mandy as I could get to a person. And when I started calling her name, you're calling her Mandy, Mandy. She was not my daughter, but I felt about her as if she were my family. I was that focused on bringing her back.
Here's where Hannah's story becomes incredible, because her actual family, her son and daughter, were missing.
By the day that we started this search for Mandy, my daughter and son had been missing for well over a year.
Before she ever became a search and rescue tracker, Hannah led a very different life. She owned a retail home decor shop in Oklahoma, and she was in an abusive marriage. For years, she endured brutal violence at the hands of her husband, until the night she had had enough.
He choked me into unconsciousness. Now, he had done that before, but this time, it hit me really hard that my two children were in their bedrooms in that house with him, and that I was dying, and they would have nobody then.
One day later, Hannah hurried her son and daughter into her car with a backpack full of clothes and drove away into hiding.
I did not expect us to survive. I believed that it would just be a matter of time till he caught up with us and did what he had always said he would do if I ever left.
So Hannah sought protection from police, family service agencies, private security guards. But she says her husband found them over and over again. She says he hunted them.
At several points and in four different states, we had the police involved and had police protection. And the officers put me in a Kevlar vest, a bulletproof vest. They had a person stationed outside the house and inside the house, outside the door of the bedroom that my children and I slept in.
Her ex-husband did get the kids. A judge allowed him temporary custody. She says the judge argued that wife abuse was irrelevant to child custody. He took the kids, and he didn't bring them back. He'd have her daughter call Hannah, and then snatch the phone away and say, "You'll never see your kids again." Hannah moved from state to state, and eventually moved to the middle of nowhere. Here, to the desert.
The desert at first was off-putting, because it was so forsaken, and I did not really know why I had chosen this.
She started to work as a volunteer park ranger, but it turns out, as a survivor of abuse, she was particularly well-suited to tracking missing persons. So she was invited to join the Joshua Tree search and rescue team.
As a battered woman and someone who was actively being stalked still, there are certain things that I pay more attention to than you would. So you don't necessarily need to see if there are footprints around your house, coming to your house at night. the level of vigilance that you have to have in order to stay ahead of somebody who's stalking you gives you really good skills, actually, for being a tracker. That kind of vigilance doesn't let a lot of stuff slide.
When Hannah and her kids would come home at the end of the day, she would search the ground around her house for tracks.
So the road has become a single track, rutted pavement, and there was a dead coyote in the middle of the road. And here there's just telephone poles and sand. And that's the house?
That's the house.
Well, it's a nice little house.
It is easily driven around before you come in. You can see tracks and footprints all the way around. This fence was
looking for a footprint on hard-packed, gravelly sand takes a mind-boggling attention to detail. Looking on the desert floor, all I saw were sticks and pebbles.
But kind of right here in this 2 square feet in front of us, what do you see?
Well, at least 6 different people have passed through here. You can see that people have stepped on, see this little stick right here and rock? That's been stepped on.
I have to say, I see nothing where you're pointing right now. I just see dirt.
Okay. You have part of a shoe here, and now, I mean, a grain of sand just fell down from it.
Did you say a grain of sand just fell off of that rock?
Yeah, it did.
You saw a grain of sand fall off?
Yes, I did. That's the kind of detail.
It seems to be, to me, an awfully exposed place for a vulnerable person to go.
It is extremely exposed, but when you are in a place like this, it is not easy to come upon me unawares. I see you coming from a long ways away in the desert, and it provided me safety at a level that I'd never had.
But she wasn't entirely safe. She still couldn't protect her kids from everything. And even in the desert, her husband would manage to get the kids again. At one point, he took them from a court hearing and disappeared. There was a nationwide manhunt for her son and daughter.
As ironic as it seems, when somebody leaves on foot from a place, I'm good at that. I can get out there and I can follow them and I would have a chance at finding them. When somebody drives off in a vehicle down a 4-lane highway with 2 children in the car, you have absolutely no easy way to follow them and know where they're going. I was sad for them all the time. No matter what I was doing, I was absolutely broken and sad and scared for what was happening to them. For the duration of that search for Mandy, for example, it became, she was their child technically, but in a way, the stakes are as high as if it were my daughter out there missing and I was looking for her. I probably had been going maybe 3 hours because we hadn't been getting detail for a while. We were in a really sandy area and she was doing a lot of weaving in and out and around, and so the direction was changing quite a lot, crossing washes and turning back on herself and all of that kind of thing. She was getting tired and confused.
And then she looked up the wash to see a little 9-year-old girl trotting towards her.
I heard her saying, "I'm Mandy," and she came into view, and there was a general huzzah across the desert from people all over the place. I was just immediately sort of swept up in that. She's safe. She's safe.
But when Hannah walked back to her home that night, she was still without her kids.
It didn't help my children a bit what I did that day. And my children were still not out of danger, and I had not one whit of skills more to be able to get them out of danger.
Eventually, her husband dropped her kids off at her door, only to take them again years later. The last and final time he took them, local detectives in the sheriff's office issued an interstate APB for her missing kids. While police across the country were searching for her son and daughter, Hannah waited by the phone.
It was a chilly day here in the high desert. I had not been able to focus very well with the children being gone. I got a phone call from the investigator's office that they had located my ex-husband in another state, and they arrested him, and then went in, and the children were not there. Always before, when my children had been missing, I felt that they were alive in the world. When I got that phone call that he'd been found and they had not, I did not have that feeling. I was completely empty. And I went outside in the desert. I stood there. I listened. I sat for long hours just on the ground, just sat down on the ground. I didn't track. I didn't think about tracking. I was just empty because I couldn't feel them anymore. It was a message on my answering machine. And the blinking light on my answering machine always signaled terror to me. But it took me some time to get to the machine and actually press the button and to listen to it. And they had left a message from the district attorney's office and the investigator saying, "We found your children. We found your children. They were alive." And I just stood there, empty and weeping. If this were some versions of Hollywood, it would have been tracking that brought my children home. The kind of tracking that I do is very simple, very down to earth. It is step by step, but none of those skills, except the practice of tracking itself, helped me with my children. The practice of tracking kept me alive and gave me hope.
Big thanks to Hannah Nyla West for sharing her story with the SNAP. And if you're wondering, Hannah's children are all grown up now, and they're all relatively safe. Read all about Hannah's amazing story on her website. We'll have a link at snapjudgment.org. And a heads up, Hannah's website has links to resources for people suffering from domestic abuse. That piece is produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Renzo Gorio. Now on Snap Judgment, the Path episode continues. We're going wherever the trail leads, even if that trail takes us to outer space. For real, right after the break, stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Check out NPR's newest show, Invisibilia. The latest episode explores what would happen if you could disappear fear and reveals the striking and rare case of a woman with no fear. From the people who created This American Life and Radiolab, Invisibilia looks at the invisible forces that shape human behavior. Subscribe to Invisibilia on iTunes now, and don't miss a single episode.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, from Yahoo Small Business, offering tools for starting, building, and growing a business, from creating a website and selling products online to attracting new local customers at smallbusiness.yahoo.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Path episode. Today we're trailing people who, for whatever reason, are following their own path. In our next story, perhaps you know the feeling. First day on the job, you're praying nothing goes wrong. But then, of course, something does. And it turns out that some people, they've got more on the line than others. Snap Judgment's Joe Rosenberg talks to Don and Mickey Pettit to share their story.
Don Pettit was 29 years old and had just gotten a PhD in chemical engineering when he did something a lot of people talk about doing, but which almost none of us ever actually do. He applied to be an astronaut.
And for that year, there were about 6,000 applicants, and I think they chose something like 10.
So Don applied again, and again, and again.
After the third rejection, I had been knocking on NASA's door for about 11 years. And the fourth time, well, here I am.
I wasn't prepared to be an astronaut's spouse. I had no idea what that meant.
This is Don's wife, Mickey. She had married Don a few years before he was selected, and she says that for a long time, the full reality of Don's new job just didn't register.
The first time I actually felt that Don was going to be an astronaut was when he did a spacewalk simulating in the pool. And watching him suit up for that.
Why? What about that made that click?
Probably the suit. You know, it's the suit that you think about the astronauts. These guys can walk around and nobody knows who they are, but as soon as you put the suit on them, they're recognized. And so maybe it was getting in that suit that you go, oh my goodness, this is really going to happen.
Was there ever any talk between you two that by some measures, this was the most dangerous job in the world?
No, it's kind of like you don't mention he who can't be named, and you kind of kick the can down the road. At least that's what I did personally, but you just kind of don't talk about it.
We didn't really sit around and go, yeah, this is dangerous, you know, and I might die from this flight, Mickey. But Don and I did discuss Challenger.
For an entire generation, the Challenger disaster of 1986 requires no introduction. Children across America had tuned in from their classrooms to watch America's first teacher, Krista McAuliffe, go into space on live TV. Instead, they got to watch the face of McAuliffe's parents when the shuttle exploded 73 seconds after launch, killing everyone on board.
So yeah, you know it could happen. You don't want it to, you don't think it will, but you know it can. It's always back there. It's always back there if you're not married to an astronaut when you watch a launch on TV, right? It's always there.
Don's first assignment wasn't technically a shuttle mission. He was going to spend 4 months on the space station, helping build it and running various experiments. But a shuttle would be taking him there. And a shuttle would be taking him home.
And about 2 days, 3 days before the launch, the spouses got to go on a pad tour. And the shuttle was on the pad. It was in its position. And we actually got to go in and see the white room where they would enter the shuttle. We got to go up to its top and touch its nose. And I kind of tried to picture Don and what he was experiencing.
And there's a really nice beach at the Kennedy Space Center itself. And Mickey and I went for a nice, secluded walk on this beach.
And I assured Don that I believed in what he was doing, and I would be okay. And we held each other, and, you know, it was kind of like this could be a goodbye.
Goodbye, but not farewell.
There's stadium seating grandstands where you can view the launches. And the spouses used to watch from those stands. But after Challenger, they were sequestered and watched from a private rooftop and watched as a group together. I went up to the top of this roof. It was at night, and you could see the shuttle lit up in the distance.
And I'd been on this rocket on the launch pad a couple of times before. However, there wasn't any fuel in the rocket. And now, the rocket is like this sleeping giant because it's breathing. You can hear it panting and groaning and popping as this cryogenic fuel steams off from the tanks. And it's highlighted in the light. And I wasn't expecting that. And the closer you got to the rocket, the more it seemed like it was a living entity all on its own, and that you knew what was going to happen when it woke up.
what can I say? It's like, it's dread. It is downright dread. Because my life could change drastically. Not just my life, but a lot of people's lives. Very shortly.
T-minus 90 seconds, stay counting.
At about T-minus 90 seconds or something like that.
All systems are go.
I just thought I was going to throw up. And then as the clock starts ticking, you see the arms move away from the shuttle. You start seeing the smoke. You start feeling the...
And you could feel the rocket kind of sway back and forth on the launch pad because the engines are going at 100%. It's like a racehorse that's still in the chocks, kind of jumping up and down for excitement. And then the solid rocket boosters light, simultaneous with blowing the bolts that hold the whole stack on the launch pad. And once those bolts go, you are going somewhere. You're going somewhere up, and you're going up fast.
And then my dread turned into awe and wonder, and you're watching it, and you want it to go. It's like, go, 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 go.
Don, meanwhile, was being pushed back in his seat so hard that in his suit, he weighed the equivalent of 750 pounds.
And at main engine cutoff, your engines cut off abruptly. You go from weighing 750 pounds to weighing 0 pounds. And that's when you know that you are in space. And when you first see the space station, you're probably 50 to 100 kilometers away. It's really, really bright. And it looks like a star. And you know that's where we're headed.
Don's crewmates on the station would be two living legends of the space program. Nikolai Budarin, a cosmonaut who had already spent several months on Mir, and Ken Bowersox, a veteran astronaut who'd flown 4 shuttle missions.
And so I was very much the inexperienced fellow, and life on station is like jumping into the deep end of the swimming pool. Thades do not work like they do on Earth. Thades are counter to your normal intuition.
For example, one of the first things a rookie astronaut will notice is that in zero gravity, even the smallest rooms feel bigger, much bigger, because you're not just using one floor, you're using 6, because the walls and ceilings are floors too.
So the shuttle is pretty roomy, but the station is voluminous, and you feel lost. You feel, wow, I need to grab onto something, but there isn't anything that I could grab onto, and I'm just floating out here in the middle and floating up to a window and looking out at Earth. You get to see views that are impossible to have when you are on Earth. On Earth, you look up and you see a meteor burning up. Well, when you are above the atmosphere, you see the meteorites burning up below you. And during my spacewalk, where I was looking down at Earth, I saw a meteorite travel between my legs 400 kilometers away.
What was the coolest thing you ever saw?
Oh, gosh. One was a total solar eclipse. It was over the Indian Ocean. I've never seen one from the surface of Earth, and I understand the physics, but to be able to look out the window and see the projected shadow of the moon on Earth, it's such an amazing moment.
And then, and you wanted me to talk about then now?
Oh, yeah.
And then Columbia, it just changed everything.
When Snap Judgment returns, the best laid plans, the stunning conclusion, right after the break. Stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Don't forget to check out NPR's newest show, Invisibilia. From the people who created This American Life and Radiolab, Invisibilia looks at the invisible forces that shape human behavior. Subscribe to Invisibilia on iTunes now, and don't miss a single episode.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the PATH episode. Now, when we last left, astronaut Don Pettit was on the space station just finishing his first space walk. The mission was going well, but then the nation received news that no one wanted to hear.
Columbia, it just changed everything.
Columbia was a shuttle that had just gone up on a mission that was separate from Don's mission on the space station. But they'd been up there at the same time, even spoken over the radio together. And now Columbia was supposed to be landing back in Florida.
February 1st, 2003. It was a Saturday. And it started off like all Saturdays. We were doing our communication with Mission Control when General Howell came on, and he told us that they just lost Columbia. And Sox and I and Nikolai was there, and we looked at each other, and it's like, what do you mean, lost Columbia? It took a while to register what was going on.
What was going on was that the shuttle had broken apart on reentry at what's called entry interface. That's where the Earth's atmosphere effectively starts, at 400,000 feet.
And as soon as it became apparent what had happened, I wanted to hear Don's voice just because I wanted to hear his voice. And when I finally did get to talk to Don, he was still hopeful that they were alive.
Because we have spacesuits, we have parachutes. If the spacecraft breaks up, possibly someone could parachute down to Earth.
But he hadn't seen what we had seen. The footage from the Texas television channels of the breakups that had been seen in the sky. And so I had to make him understand that that was not going to happen. I don't know if I was mean or not. I might have been. I said, "Don, don't you get it?" And his voice changed. And he said, "Of course I get it, Mickey. They're my friends."
Willie McCool and I were really close. And he helped me a lot in my earlier training days. And then we both loved to play chess. And so we were playing a ship-to-ship game of chess. Where he was making moves and I was making moves, and we each had our little chess set that could be folded flat. And I still have that chess set, and the pieces are still in the same location that they were at that time.
Who was winning?
Willie.
With the shuttle program now on hold, Don, Ken, and Nikolai weren't stranded on the space station. They had a backup craft, a Russian Soyuz capsule, that they could take down and land in Kazakhstan. And both Don and Mickey said they had a great deal of confidence in the Soyuz. Prior to Columbia, its track record was about as good as the shuttle's. But, on the flip side, its track record was about as good as the shuttle's.
And in some respects, each time you fly, you're rolling dice with the universe. The only way for us to get home is to roll the dice one more time. And we knew That was the name of the game when we started this mission.
After 6 months in space, Don, Ken, and Nikolai all piled into the Soyuz and departed from the space station, while Mickey watched from mission control in Moscow, along with Ken Bowersox's wife, Annie, and the head of NASA, Sean O'Keefe.
It really looked more like a theater. Like the stage was way down below and you sat above it. And I also remember it was very dark because they'd only put lights on where you needed lights. And we could hear Nikolai's voice communicating.
This is Nikolai's voice from that reentry. It was recorded by Don, actually, from inside the capsule.
And we're told that there would be this period of non-communication. And that's the most intense, because they're going through the atmosphere. They're going to burn up. They're going to do it then.
Meanwhile, back in the Soyuz, Don was still recording.
Everything okay over there, Don? That was a nice kick in the pants, you know?
And then when you hit the upper atmosphere, your spacecraft separates into three pieces. And Sox was excited. Sox was saying, because this was all happening in Russian. I see our propulsion unit burning up. And I looked out of my window and, I see our living habitat burning up.
What did Nikolai say?
He was quiet. I don't recall him saying anything at all. And he was probably thinking, that's not right. You shouldn't be able to see those. And we had no idea that that was the first indication of our malfunction.
Their malfunction, as they'd later learn, was that their capsule was coming in sideways, forcing them into something called a ballistic entry. And a ballistic entry means pretty much exactly what you might guess it means. That instead of gliding back to Earth, the Soyuz was about to plummet at around 17,000 miles per hour.
And once you enter a ballistic entry, the physics is set. You know that you're going to enter the atmosphere steeper. You know things are going to get hotter. You know the G levels are going to be higher. And you know that you are going to land way off course.
And the highest G-forces I had experienced up to that point were around 4.5 Gs.
That's like a gorilla sitting on your chest. So Nikolai was reading off the gravity levels. Peregruska
4.
Peregruska 6.
5.
6. Peregruska 6.
And it's kind of hard to turn your head, but I did, and I could see these little streamers of liquid running across the outside of the window. But these streamers were not water. These streamers were glowing, red-hot bits of metal, and at that point in time, our G levels were 8 to 9 Gs.
But back in mission control in Moscow, they didn't know about the ballistic entry. They had heard Nikolai's voice punch through again. And so they assumed Don and the rest were just fine.
But it became apparent by the intenseness of the conversations that I was hearing in Russian and the look on the people's faces that something was not right. And then when it really became apparent was when Annie and I were shuffled into a room. We were told in this room, there would be something for us to eat. Now, Annie and I are both proactive and wanted to know what was going on. We didn't want to be handled. And, you know, to the credit of the men, and they were all men, they were pretty frank about everything and told us that they hadn't located them. The helicopters didn't know where they were.
And the thing to remember here is that this was the first landing since Columbia. And now, just like Columbia, there was no spectacular explosion, no Mayday distress call. The ship simply failed to arrive.
I was like, God, this can't be happening. This cannot be happening. Not this, not again. Not another damn landing that doesn't work. And that didn't just come from me. Sean O'Keefe was sitting behind me going, where the hell are they? What I was hearing was people coming in and out with their cell phones going, have you heard? Have you heard? Have they found? What's going on? Like I was going to get any more information than them? I didn't think so. So what are you supposed to do? You just got to wait. And I think it was somewhere around 4 hours that we waited when somebody comes in and says, we got them. The helicopters have spotted them. They're okay.
As you can hear, Don and the crew were more than okay. They had survived the 8.5G reentry and made it through the atmosphere. This is the sound of them celebrating when their parachute deployed.
And at that point, I commented to Nikolai, now we can live for another day. And he commented back, he said,
medical test is done.
And we went thump, roll, roll. And we were once again reunited with dirt. And when the hatch first opened, the smell of crushed spring grass hit us to say that we had arrived. And the countryside where we'd landed was just flat. There was nobody around. We had landed so far off course. And we just laid in the dirt, face up, sort of three people radiating out like spokes on a wheel, and our senses were being overloaded with the sound of springtime birds chirping, the wind rustling across the top of us, and we could see some puffy clouds overhead in the blue sky. And it was just a moment where we were having a communion with Earth.
That's when the helicopter spotted them and radioed in the good news. A little less than a day later, they were back at the airport in Moscow, where Mickey was waiting.
So we go out there, and it's like this slow-motion gauntlet of people and cameras in your face. And I'm seeing somebody in front of me going, Mickey, this way. And I'm following that person, and I go up to the plane and get on the plane, and then there's Don looking like a wreck. But he looks... but there he was.
How was this for a first mission?
Ooh, well, there was nothing typical about this mission, was it?
No, there wasn't.
Oh, Lord. How was this for a first?
What a way to get introduced to space flight.
Since that first mission, Mickey has watched Don launch two more times. And all told, Don has now spent over a year in space. And when asked whether he has any plans to retire, Don says no way. I have to drag him out feet first. Special thanks to Don's crewmate, Ken Bowersox, who helped us immensely with this story, and Chris Jones, who first covered these events in Esquire magazine. For links to his book, Out of Orbit, into some really fun videos that Don made while in space, check out our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece is produced by Joe Rosenberg with sound design by Leon Morimoto. It's that time. We're packing stuff up, moving down our own path. But if you want more Snap, not to fear. Subscribe to the amazing Snap Judgment podcast and get days of Snap storytelling free for the asking. The best deal in storytelling history. And tell a friend before we have to shut this down. Subscribe now at snapjudgment.org. snapjudgment.org. You'll find behind-the-scenes pictures, movies, and full-on episodes. snapjudgment.org. Snap was produced by myself and a team that knows exactly where they're going. Please say hello to the navigator himself, Mr. Mark Ristich. Filling with the radio, Pat Macedi Miller, Anna, the backseat driver Sussman, Joe Tollbooth Rosenberg, Julia, Oil Change DeWitt, Nancy, Car Wash Lopez. You call him Davey, the crash dummy Kim, Full Service Renzo Gorio, the off-road crew, Eliza Smith, Anna Adlerstein, Aurora Soria, and Leon Morimoto. GPS provided by Jasmine Aguilera. Now, did you ever not know where you're going? Only be told, I don't think you know where you're going? That reminder today is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thanks so much for letting us know. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, doesn't know where they're going either, but not to fear, because the dude abides. PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago knows but won't tell. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, after the bank robbery, you can hop in the getaway car only to discover that's not Frankie behind the wheel. That's your Aunt Sally. And she refuses to step on it no matter how much you scream. Even then, even with all that, it's not as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.